Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
The first Rock and Roll Friday of 2010 on the Savage Nation, and I'm live from a hidden location somewhere in the United States of America. Welcome to the Savage Nation, as I say, the first show of the year. I couldn't be gone. I was supposed to be gone, but you know, these are strange times, very difficult times. I had a very unusual New Year's Eve. I didn't so much as drink a beer. I got off the air last night, and I'm just counterintuitive or whatever you say, counter-suggestive. Everyone's supposed to get drunk New Year's Eve. I normally drink. I don't drink at all on New Year's Eve. And I had one of the best, what's that now? I had one of the best New Year's Eves of my life by not drinking. Would you believe it? Can I tell you what I did for New Year's Eve? I'll tell you what I did for New Year's Eve. I went home. I made shrimp and spaghetti with marinara sauce. I then went on my bicycle and I rode to a town in an undesignated location that was celebrating New Year's Eve. You know, a small town somewhere in America. Street was closed off, banned in the street. And I just mingled with the crowd, with the bicycle. I saw people, the children, the dogs. And it was a beautiful night to ride around on a bicycle in a warm place and go home. Now, I had some interesting dreams for New Year's Eve. You're listening to the Savage Nation. I will do politics eventually. Last night was heavy political and heavily political, and so there's no point in doing it again tonight. If you missed last night's show, it's a shame. There are political stories. There's no question we have a doofus for president. After another almost 9/11, the man says nothing and doesn't fire Big Sis. It's one after another. The Fort Hood massacre, they swept under the rug. I mean, we can do all of that, but I'm not going to do it again. I'd rather talk about my New Year's Eve and my dream. I got to tell you my dream. So I told you I was off for like a week and a half. I was supposed to finish off the whole week and come on next week. But with all the things going on in the world, I decided to go on yesterday. So blah, blah, blah. So I do the show, had the dinner, go on the bike ride. Now I get home and I go to sleep. And I have profound dreams. I've told you this before. I'm one of the few people on earth who remembers his dreams. I've trained myself to remember my dreams, and I dream in color. To me, it's better than television. And it's funny, since I've been away now for a couple of weeks, I'm not watching TV at night, and all the dreams now are my own. It's a strange phenomenon. I'm not having like wacko dreams based on movie inputs from the sickest minds of our generation. It's all my own subconscious. So listen to this one. In this dream, I know you're interested in it because everybody wants to know how the other man, you know, lives, thinks, and works. And let me back up for a minute before you say I'm a little too self-indulgent. Here's what you're going to get from me if you don't know it already. You're going to get communication of the highest human order. Humans who are really good communicators admit to doubt, to pain, to grief, and failure. Humans who never admit to doubt, pain, grief, or failure are not really good humans. They're kind of robotic. And so I will tell you now the rest of the story. So I have the dream. I'm trying to get home, and I can't. And there's a car that's going, and I try to get to it, and I miss the car. And all of a sudden, there's Al Pacino. Al Pacino is in the dream. I don't know why. I never think of Al Pacino. I'm not in love with him. And we start to talk, and I tell him I want to play the tenor saxophone that he had in his hand. I said, please give it to me. He gives it to me. I take the mouthpiece off, and I wash the mouthpiece, which is very significant. And they look at me like, what's wrong with you, man? Why are you washing the mouthpiece? And my answer is because I don't want your germs, Johnson. So I wash the mouthpiece. I stick it back on the horn. And I say to myself, I don't really know how to play this instrument, but I wanted to play it all my life. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to I'm going to just fake it. I'm going to try my best, and I'll bet you I can do something with it. And all of a sudden, and here's the best part of the dream, the music starts to flow out of me like a great jazz artist. I mean, it's flowing. It's incredible. I'm in control. I got everything working. And all of a sudden, an orchestra comes up out of behind me and starts to follow my music. And I said, that's one of the greatest feelings I've ever had in my life. Now, this was in a dream. Wake up, think about it. What is the dream? The dream was, is I went on the radio yesterday when I wasn't scheduled to do so. And after picking up the horn, which is the microphone, I started to play my instrument, which is the microphone. And I really created some incredible music yesterday. And you, the orchestra, were with me. That's it. That's the story. So the tenor saxophone is a beautiful instrument. Let's hear Stan Getz and Desafinado on the Savage Nation. This is Michael Savage, heard on hundreds of radio stations across America, although I have not been in a hospital on a stunt for the last few days. My ratings are quite good. As a matter of fact, my Q went up 300,000 a week last year, I found out. That's the cumulative audience, went up 300,000 people a week over the Savage Nation without pulling stunts of any kind. So if you'd like to call the show and tell me what you did for New Year's Eve, please don't, because I'm not interested. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. I don't know whether we're going to even talk. I don't even know if anyone's listening. That's the beauty tonight. This is going to be very much like the Play Misty for Me Clint Eastwood movie where I'm a disc jockey. Hey, does anyone remember that movie, Clint Eastwood, in Play Misty for Me, where he's a DJ in a small town like Carmel, Monterey? And he gets stalked by this chick, this hippie chick. She was pretty good looking. And is that in it? Okay, it's in that thing called Misty. No, I loved it. He had a Jaguar XK140 drop head coupe. He was so great in that movie. It was such a great movie. But the point is, like, he was a DJ in a small radio station on a coastal city in California in the 70s when radio was kind of schlocky, easy fun instead of this big, commercial, gigantic heart attack medium that it's become. It was fun. It was a different world. I wasn't in it, but I hear it was different. Because I went in at 94 when it was what it is today, thank God. So this is going to be like me in a dark room. It's nighttime. I'm on a microphone. The audience is probably, my intuitive guess, 50 to 60% of normal tonight. 50 to 60% of norm. That's okay with me. I mean, still millions of people out there listening to the show. In fact, I would guess that everyone's off. Everyone is off. Every big shot on Fox News, CNN, they're all, St. Bart's, Dublin, wherever they are, Miami, in the Naples, Florida, in the mansion, walking around. But they're all going to listen. They want to know what the other guy is doing, because I know I do something. You can't just take off. What, do you shut your mind down? So I figured I'm going to come on the air. Just as I didn't drink last night because it was New Year's Eve, I decided to come on the air January 1st because it's 2010 and I want to lead the year. I want to lead the year. I had such a great time last night. Let me go back to that dream. If I could live in one dream I've had my whole life, it wouldn't be, let me try, it's a family show. It wouldn't be, let's say, the dreams I had that were lustful. Okay, is that the... I would like, if you say, okay, Michael, you're going to go before God at the end of the road, and he's going to say to you, okay, here's the story, man. I want you to just tell me about your dreams. What? Yep. Because your life on earth is just the positive. I want to hear about the other side, the negative side, which are your dreams. And I want you to tell me what they were. And when you get to heaven, you have a capacity to remember every dream you had in your entire life. Just spill it out. Just put it up on the digital screen for me, Savage. I'm a busy guy. We got a lot coming through here today. Well, you know, the best dream I've had in my life was on December 31st, 2009, God, when I picked up a tenor sax, cleaned the mouthpiece, and I played the greatest music in the world, and an orchestra appeared behind me. You know, I'm telling you this because I'm trying to entertain you. I know many of you are depressed by what's going on in the world. Believe me, I know. I talk to people. They are depressed over the imposter. They're depressed over the psychopaths in the government. They're depressed over the left-wing maniacs who are compliant with the Islamo-fascist. They're depressed over the gangsters in Congress who have bankrupted the country and are taxing us to death. They're depressed with the gangster Democrats who are going to legalize illegal aliens. The people be damned. They are depressed. They're angry. They're ready to just react. They don't have a leader, though. No one has led the people yet. There's no leader who has appeared, the man on the white horse, to come along to save America. Right now we have people on oxen leading America in the wrong direction. 1-800-449-8255. There's another good tenor sax piece that I want to talk about, and that is Speedo. Let's hear Speedo for a moment, because this is one of my favorite rock and roll songs. Listen to the saxophone in this one, especially when he goes into the lower registers. Now listen to this one. If you're a musician, you'll know what I mean. There's one piece where the sax arcs. Listen. Oh! I trained my whole career to be able to play a saxophone like that. Just give me a beaten up horn and put me in East St. Louis. You could even change me to a black band. I don't care. I don't care. That doesn't matter to me. Racism, the issue to me. It's what's inside, not what's outside. The best music ever heard in my life was in East St. Louis. I told you that story. Turn it off already. They heard it. I only wanted to hear that one saxophone piece. If you can get it near there again. First of all, let me back up. I want to thank Doug Lynn. Doug, let's hear a round of applause for Doug. And I want to thank Phil. Phil, where are you? Phil Newmark, for coming in today. Everyone else is off. Thank you very much for being with me. We're having, I said, guys, I want to thank you for destroying your weekend and having your family mad at you for not being with them. But, you know, this is a big weekend for domestic violence. I may be doing people a favor. And I'm not saying anything about you guys, but, you know, these are the weekends when Charlie Sheen, you know, what do you think it happens now? It's all right. New Year's Eve is over. Christmas is over. The average guy, you know what he's got to look forward to now? Nothing. The rest of the year, the next thing he's got to look forward to is an income tax check. Domestic violence levels now start to rise on Friday night. I'd say it's up 30% from last week. No, it's after the presents, the children. One of them has the flu. By Sunday night, the police are going to be so busy in America with domestic violence calls. It's horrible. You know, everybody suppresses themselves with medication. It's very dangerous. The Prozac-like compounds repress the rage, repress. And all of a sudden, bango, it's suicide or homicide. In my day, you didn't repress it. You yelled. The object was to yell all the time. You screamed and you yelled when you didn't feel good. You got it out of your system. And you did it in front of the children so they knew what real life was like. So they don't wind up like, oh, yeah, I need a teddy bear every time I hear a loud firecracker go off. You know what I'm saying? What kind of world do we live in? Everything is teddy bears and balloons and candy when people die. So there we go. Now play that saxophone for me one more time, and I'm not taking a break yet. I don't care. So I'm walking around the crowd last night, and I see the average American enjoying himself, and I say, all right, fine, I'm on the bike, pushing the bike. There's people, dogs, children. I say, you know why the radical Muslims are on the warpath? I said, here's why. We have a corrupt government. We have a cowardly leadership. We have a left-wing press, and then we have a compliant population that doesn't know their arse from their elbow. And the Muslim, the radical Muslim who's been on the warpath for 1,300 years, he knows he's not going to do this today. He knows he's not going to do this tomorrow, but he knows that through attrition he can take over the world simply by continuing his bloodbath, his slow bleeding. Remember I told you the story about killing by 1,000 lashes. Do you remember I told you that story? That in ancient times, if the Arabs really wanted to torture somebody, they didn't kill them with a sword blow to the neck. They cut them 1,000 times, and then they bled to death slowly. We are being hit by 1,000 sword cuts, and that's why we're dying, because we don't have the leadership necessary to unleash the missiles, unleash the bombs, unleash the airplanes, and don't give me the crap that we don't know where they are. Don't give me that lie that we don't know where their headquarters are. Don't give me the garbage that we don't know who their leaders are. Don't give me that crap. I don't want to hear it. All I want to do is hear the tenor sax and have sweet dreams. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation. Memories, Dreams, and Reflections was written by Jung, of course. And, you know, good radio is good radio. variety of the personality depends upon the personality. You could do politics till you're blue in the face and people would not listen to you. You could do it till you're blue in the face and they will listen to you, depending upon who you are in your delivery. But if I would have only do politics, I would have left this business a long time ago. As I say to you, I am a communicator, and I've been brought up to admit what's going on inside me to people, you know, when I want to now. And certainly not everything. I mean, if I told you everything that was going on inside me or everything I did, I'd be crazy. That would be the mark of insanity. It's a public show. But I admit doubt. I admit pain. I admit grief. I admit failure. I don't think failure is dirty like a disease. I've had failure in my life. But I remember being taught when I was a young boy, how many times have I told you the story about my father's friend who was the bar owner, the tough guy that all the boys loved the most? The other guys were very nice, the men. Every man in the constellation of father's male friends were decent men, good men. Nobody ever did anything. No one touched anyone inappropriately. I don't even think it entered their mind. I don't know how this happened. But anyway, everyone was a decent guy. But this guy was a standout because he was unlike the rest of them. He was a tough guy, a street fighter, wound up owning a bar, a gambler, very unusual, quiet, soft-spoken, hands like the size of, but quiet to women, to his wife, the nicest man on earth. But the boys gravitated to him. And I remember what he told us about, you know, what to expect in life. He said, you know, you can only wear one suit at a time. You don't have to be rich. He used to tell us things like that. You don't have to struggle to be rich. And then he would tell us things like, do you know how many times my rich friend has been down and had nothing? He said three or four times he's had nothing and come back. He said he used to say things to us like he knew how to bounce back. Now, as a kid, you don't know what the word bounce back means. But when you get older and you've been kicked in the teeth a few times and you're in the gutter of your soul, you have to learn how to rise again like a phoenix. And that's a very tricky thing to do. Most people get knocked down once and they never come back from it. Do you know that? But what I'm saying to you is a lot of things, and I don't want to summarize with a quick jab at the end.
Savage.
January 1, 2010. Did you actually think you'd make it? Did you actually think that you'd be alive in the year 2010? I mean, when you think about it. Did you actually think that there'd be an imposter in the White House? Did you actually think that there would be a man in the White House who could not have passed the FBI clearance to become an FBI agent and that he would get through this and that nobody would say a word in the media? Would you actually believe that we'd be living in a time like this where whacked-out left-wing college types who think that they're still having a good time blowing whistles in the dorm are actually running America and are in charge of the military? Would you believe that this is the country that you've inherited where gangsters in suits and ties can rob you with impunity by writing bills that filch your hard-earned money and give it to their friends? Would you believe that you'd live in a time like this when gangsters in suits who work for so-called investment banks and then go to work for the United States government can simply write themselves checks for billions and billions of dollars and not go to jail? Would you believe you're living in a time like this when gangsters in suits and skirts can write themselves checks for any amount of money? Would you believe you're living in a time when Don Corleone's granddaughter could not have done better than they're doing today? Would you believe you're living in a time like this when people who have never shot a Daisy BB gun are in charge of the United States military? Would you believe you're living in a time like this when the defense secretary, despite all evidence hitting him in the face, Allah Akbar, Jihad, white robe, says, I'm not even going there, and nobody gives a damn about those killed at Fort Hood? Would you believe you're living in a time when a man, a Flying Dutchman, leaps over a chair and stops another fanatic Muslim on an airplane from killing hundreds of people, and our so-called head of security at Homeland Security, whatever her name is, says everything worked just fine, that the government did just the right thing? Would you believe you're living in a time when there is no opposition party, when you're living in a single-party system under the guise of the government media complex? Would you believe any of this would be happening in your time? Well, I would, because I am, and I'm here, and here we are, and here we go. And the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Let's begin this segment by taking a call out of New York City. Sal on WOR. Go ahead, Sal. What's on your mind?
Savage, I just wanted to tell you, last night, you're coming on the air. The anticipation before you came on was that of a concert. And what you, your dialogue that you just spoke was tenor sax. For those with the ears to hear the high notes that you're hitting, that was a sax.
Sal, first of all, thank you. But wait a minute, the anticipation, of me, how did you know I was going to come on? Because I didn't know I was going to go on until like a few hours before it wasn't announced.
Yeah, I didn't. I missed you. And then just waiting to see.
You mean because of the fill-ins and the best-ofs and all of that.
And then all of a sudden, it was like that of an explosion, like a concert, like appearing on a stage when no one knew you were there. You know what I'm saying?
That's interesting, Sal. Well, no, that's what happens when you build an audience of loyalists like yourself who love you, want to hear you, and they follow you. And, you know, I can't disappoint people like you. I perform for you. I got to repeat again that something people don't know is that joint endeavors mean joint responsibilities. And my responsibility to you, Sal, and everyone else is to appear and do a great show to the best of my ability. That's my responsibility to you.
Sax, it comes out of your lips better than other lips. It's like playing a jukebox and picking a song that you know is better. That this guy sings it better. This guy hits the high note. This guy delivers it like a musician. So the dream, you are playing a sax. It's just not a musical sax. It's a different type of a sax. You just played a hit song just before you took my call, and I sat here and listened to it. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was like. It couldn't have came from nobody else any better, Mr. Savage. I've been listening to you since 99, and, you know.
No, all I can say is I'm glad you're out there, Sal, you and the others who listen to the show. And I can give you a gift of Band in Britain because I'd like to do that. So please stay on the line, and we'll get one out to you as soon as possible. Let's play a little Desafinado for a minute as I catch my breath before I go back to politics, as unusual on the Savage Nation. You know what I'm looking at? I got distracted during the break. I went on to The Sun from England, and it's pictures of British girls drunk in the snow. On the one hand, you want to cry. On the other hand, you say, you know, the symbol of the British girls lying face down in the snow, drunk. And by the way, this isn't the first time I've seen these pictures. Something has happened to Britain where it has affected the girls more than anybody else. They become, too many of them, stone-hearted slut drunks, laying in the gutter like filthy hookers. It seems to be the face of England today. Girls in high heels laying drunk in the gutters of England. It's sort of, well, let's play There Ain't No England Anymore, because to me, it's symbolic of England, and it's sad. It's nothing you can have pleasure like this. I've never seen girls in America laying down like this in the gutter. Why are the British, the Brits, so drunk? And why are the girls so whacked out on a drink over there? What happened to them? These are girls that would have had babies in the past. What's going on? What happened to England? Well, you see these pictures on my website, michaelsavage.com. Their dresses thrown over their head, laying in the snow, drunk. You don't know what to do for a country like this. You know, having pinkos. The girls have no one to look up to, no one to follow. No wonder they get drunk and throw themselves in the street. I love this. And I'm not watching television. I'm more inspired in some ways and less on. I mean, yeah, I got some good things out of television because I don't like, there's not a lot of good TV now. I love The Sopranos. That's over. How many times can I watch a rerun? How many times can I watch him knock a gardener out of the tree and enjoy it? How many times can I watch Goodfellas and get a kick out of it till I realize it's real, you know, serious, chopping a guy up in a trunk? I mean, how many times can I... You see what's going on in Mexico? I found the story out of the LA Times. I put it on michaelsavage.com. Nice young Hispanic American guy. He's a city councilman in a small town in Southern California. He goes to Mexico. He goes to dinner with his wife. The banditos break in. They kidnap him and four other men. They execute him, throw him in the garbage, in the gutter. What's going on in Mexico? Do you have any idea the war at our doorstep? And this government wants to make illegal aliens legal? Do you have any idea how incompetent this government is? And by the way, they're not the first incompetent. Bush was the same. Okay, so don't start telling me about Obama. Bush tried to do it too. And McShane the Shame passed the Illegal Immigration Legal Act. You know, just give him a pass. So this is coming up. He can bankrupt America, nationalize the banks, nationalize health care, nationalize the automobile industry, and then flood us with 30 million criminals if they try it. I predict that the town hall meetings were like a child's birthday party compared to what's coming if this gang tries to force this down our throats. That's my prediction. I'm not going to lead it. You don't need me to lead it. Millions of you know what this is all about. Millions of you know what is at stake. Millions of you know that if they legalize 30 million illegal aliens and their kin, it's all over. You will have the equivalent of the wrecked socialist state of Mexico. We will have the most melted down country. It's over. It'll never come back from the hell that they will drag us into. And that is worth fighting for, let me tell you that. That is worth fighting for, because if they do that, they will have a perennial vote for socialism in this country. Let me explain that again to you. If they get those 30 million illegal aliens in here, they'll vote one socialist left-wing government after another for the rest of your life and probably your children's life. You know, there was a time that Mexico was a semi-prosperous nation. And then what happened was is that it became totally corrupted in the 1930s. And socialism crept in, and the country truly never recovered from that. And now they're going to import this mentality to this country? So there I say to you, I'm not making a prediction, but I'm saying to you, as I sit here, if I'm going to make any kind of political prediction, that if this gang tries to pull that one off on the American people, and I can guarantee you as I stand here in front of this microphone, that this is not just a Republican thing. This is not just a Democrat thing. I've seen every poll. This is an American thing. Most Americans want the illegals not only stopped, they want them thrown out of the country. Let me go a step further. They don't want another passive, let's sit here and wait for the next radical Muslim attack, and then we'll see what mistakes were made. They're tired of it. They want them kicked out. They want them out of this country. They are sick of it. They don't like the demographic change, if I may be very blunt about it. They don't like the cultural change, the social change. They don't like any of it. But worse than that, they don't like the political change that came with the illegals. How do you think people like Barbara Boxer, Hillary Clinton, Dianne Feinstein, and Barack Obama get elected? How do you think it happens? By rigging the ballot box with illegal aliens primarily. That's how it happens. And so you say, well, how did this happen? How did this happen? You've seen nothing yet. If you let them get away with granting amnesty to the 30 million illegal aliens, you may as well leave the country, because you're not going to be you will be a stranger in your own land. So that's all I'm going to say on this today. It's too early in the year to get too excited. But I've already gotten more excited than I wanted to get. And here we are, the first of the year, and off and running at the races. New Year's Eve, my dream, tenor sax, Stan Getz. Let's have a little Speedo. And away we go on the Speedo multi-protocol label switching devices operating. MPLS operating. How do you spend a vacation? It's like being a kid again in all these weeks. It's funny, I stopped watching television. I watch television out of anxiety. I fill my head with the poison of the worst minds of my generation. I spend a lot of time reading. I'm reading like a kind of a boring biography I told you about a woman who was married to Hemingway, Martha Gellhorn, and it by Carolyn Moorhead. I don't like the book at all because she's a super left-winger who was talking in this book about how the poor Vietnamese were picked on by evil America and how our troops were basically fascists. It was awful, just horrible. And when you get confronted by left-wing lies, it's unbelievable how she doesn't talk about what the communists did to the people in Vietnam, only about the evil American soldier. It's so sickening to read this. But this is all worked into this book about, Gellhorn. And I'm a little fascinated by it for a couple of reasons. And then I'm reading Hemings Motor News. I know you say, well, how do you go from that to that? Because I don't know, I'm still a kid in my heart, and I collect cars, a few cars here and there. I'm looking at getting rid of the 65 Caddy that I have, the convertible, with 55,000 miles. I'm probably going to auction it off of my website and put the money into the Michael Savage Legal Defense Fund. Whatever it brings, I don't really care. And I might pick up, an old Corvette. It's like, I don't know why I want it. They're not that great. You could buy a new one that's better. You look at the prices in the Hemmings Motor News of used cars, and you have to have your head examined to buy one of them when you look at it. You know, I remember I wanted them when I was a kid. Imagine what you want, like a 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60 Corvette. I was in high school in those days, so to me, the idea of having like a 1959 Corvette would have been nirvana. I mean, you know, boys at that age of their life, to them, a car is the whole world. The entire world is wrapped around what kind of car you can get or you can drive, and I couldn't get anything. My first car was a 57 Olds two-door salesman's car, still one of the greatest, you know, cars I ever had because it was my first. In fact, I wrote about it in Psychological Nudity. I remember sitting in the rain when my dad brought it home so he could, you know, he surprised me. It was green, two-door salesman's car with a post. My whole night was spent thinking how to cut the post out of the door to make it look like a coupe. It was so uncool to have a car like with a post in it. But the Oldsmobile sat there, and I went and sat in the street in the rain and watched the raindrops beat up on the windshield. Beautiful car. Piece of junk today, you know. But you look at like 56 Corvette, $66,000. 57 Vet, blah, blah, blah. Who's going to pay 100 grand for these things? I don't know why. I mean, here, 60 Corvette, Roman red with white insert, Wunderbar radio, photos, manual, numbers match, $62,000. I'd go buy a new one for $62,000 if I wanted it. That's the whole point. I don't want a car that stinks in the garage. All these cars stink in the garage. They, no matter what you do to them, they smell. The whole house stinks. Who needs it at the end of the day? But who needs that? Who needs anything? Who needs anything when you come right down to it? Do you want it, really? A thing like this. What else did I like? Flag. Thank God for Post-its. Whoever invented the Post-it should get the Nobel Prize. He did more for the world than Obama. No, I'm saying whoever came up with the Post-it has done more for the world than Obama and everyone who works for the Obama administration. Think about it. I got the tags in here. Let me see what I tagged. Here, wait. Oh, private estate liquid. No. There's an auction coming up in Fort Lauderdale on January 8th, 9th, and 10th. And a car caught my eye. A 1960 Jaguar XK150S Roadster. A pile of junk. God only knows, one of the worst cars ever built, but gorgeous like you cannot believe. Trouble. Oh, man. I used to own Jags, 59s. What trouble they were. I had a mechanic friend. This guy would try his best. No matter what you did, you couldn't fix those engines properly. Now you're talking about cars. You look at these Ferraris, man. They're nice. They're pretty nice, but they roar. They're great. Nice-looking machines. But at a certain point in your life, what's a car? You want to sit in the back, not in the front. You know what I mean? At this point, you want to go in the back of the bus. You don't want to drive. What else we got? Cadillac Coupe de Ville. Remember that? Wow, the good they looked in those days. Here, Cadillac. Moish had a Cadillac. On the mink coat. Here, 1960 Cadillac Eldorado Biarritz convertible. Only 1,285 built, originally from California. Champagne exterior, matching original, blah, blah, blah. Dual backup lights, power window, $64,500. Sold for $4,900. I don't know. People want them. You drive down the street in a parade, I suppose. 59 Caddy convertible. Remember those with the fins? They're nice. But what do you need it for when you think about it? What do you need it? You need my car, my 65 Caddy convertible, you need, because I owned it. Right? Remember the age when hippies were buying hearses? That was a fun age. The hearses, the hippie chicks in the hearses. There was something about it, the patchouli oil and the hair, no hair, no shaving. And then how did it end up? Everything starts out like fantasy. You got the hearse, the girl, the babies, the commune, free love. The next thing you know, it's Manson murdering people in a house. What is the moral of that story? Which is that man needs constraints or he becomes a wild animal capable of anything. That's what it means. See, that's what it is. The hippie era taught America one thing, which is that unrestricted, unbridled freedom leads to insanity and murder. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Me, Michael Savage, in charge of Homeland Security, I arrest them on return to the country. I arrest every lawyer coming back from Guantanamo, and I investigate them for ties to terrorism. You ought to thank your lucky stars that I don't want to be a politician. You red diaper dopa baby rats. If it was me, I'd arrest you on return from Gitmo. You American lawyers going down there to undermine this country and embarrass us, I'd put you in jail, and I'd throw the key away.
Savage.
And they all said about the same thing. You tell the truth. I said, what do you mean I tell the truth? Well, I don't have to agree with everything you say, but at least I know what to think based upon what you're saying to me. I don't hear BS from you, meaning you're expressing what you believe to be true, and that's good enough for me because we're living in a world of bullcrap. Everyone's lying to us. Everything's done with a focus group. Everything's done with a finger in the air to see which way the wind is blowing before they say it. You say it the way you see it, and people, common people, like that. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. Blame Misty for me. Here I am sitting in a dark little studio somewhere in a coastal city. No Jaguar XK140 MC outside, of course. And, of course, no stalker. No, come on. So I was, I think, like reading Hemings Motor News. I went to an auction, and I bought some bronzes because Dad used to sell them. I bought interesting two bronzes that are interesting at an auction. Not expensive. A couple of $100 each, like less than $1,000. One is of an Indian shaman holding up like a head of an animal with feathers. Beautifully done. And another bronze of an Indian warrior on a horse. You know, they're like copy, like Remington-like copies. They're nicely done. And I got a paint. I got beautiful painting. I knew that no one knew what this was. I went to the auction preview. And it's mainly, you know, European stuff that people, you know, the lots come in for all these houses. This was a silk painting in India, a silk painting from India, a large one, that I knew was a masterpiece. Now, I don't know India paintings from India from a hole in the wall. I have an intuition about it, though. I'm going to have this appraised when I get back. I paid about, I think, $500, $600. I have a feeling it's a masterpiece because it's flawless, number one, and the faces are perfect. I've been in enough curry houses in my lifetime, to tell you. No, you know the kind of painting I'm talking about, the Indian-like paintings where you see the finely chiseled, you know, Taj Mahal face. You know what I'm talking about. So I figured that there's got to be, like, some rich Indian guy out there who's going to pay me a fortune for this one. It's beautiful. It shows, like, a whole life story. There's the prince on the horse and his retainer and his soldier, and then there's the merchants and the camels carrying. It's like on the Silk Road. I think I'm going to put it up on the website, you know, going in, how much it might be at 30, blah, blah. All right, Michael Savage, multi-protocol label. Stop it, guys.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Tenor sax for you. You know, I'm looking through my website, and there's some stories. I mean, it's not to promote the website. They're frightening. Here's one out of Houston, Texas. Rocket launcher found in apartment, no charges filed. Now, there's a reason I'm going to read this to you. A man is forcing his way into an apartment. Officers go inside. They find an AT-4 shoulder-mounted rocket launcher, which can shoot a missile 1,000 feet through buildings and tanks. Right? It could go through battle tanks. It could knock out armored vehicles. And the rocket launcher belongs to a man named Nabalai Iwansani, who also had jihadist literature in his apartment. They found jihadist writings that belonged to him. They find a rocket launcher, and they can't charge him with any, they cannot make any charges related to the rocket launcher or writings because it's the United States of America. So the guy has jihadist writings. He's a radical Muslim. And he has a rocket launcher. And again, it's nothing. The former head of the FBI says that the rocket launchers can be dangerous. But there's Houston police said they did a thorough investigation. And they didn't find any ties to terrorists or a terrorist network. You hear? These are the doofuses, the flatfoots that are protecting us. It's unbelievable to me. Homeland Security, no problem. Everything worked fine. Fort Hood massacre, defense secretary, don't even go there. A rocket launcher found in an apartment in Houston and jihadist writings, but we can't arrest him because he didn't do anything yet. You hear the country you're living in? I've never seen anything like that. Just an empty tube. Just an empty tube. Bring them all in. Bring in more of them. Or bring them all in to make America more diverse. Grant all of them amnesty. My friends. I hate that phrase. It's like Benjamin Franklin from high school. Friends, Romans, and countrymen. Caesar, Julius Caesar. Remember that? I didn't read that. I can't call you my friends. You don't know me. I'm not your friend. Look at these stories. Stay away from Mexico. Americans abducted and executed. Rocket launcher found in Houston apartment. Here's a good story for you who are germophobic. I'm a germaphobe. As anyone sneezes, I leave the room. I was in a house of worship 3 weeks ago. Everything was going well till a sneezer appeared 2 rows ahead of me. I left. That's all. God would have to understand, I figured. But it was not just a sneeze. I'm not talking about a dust sneeze. This was a mucosal sneeze that could have infected the entire house of worship. And the guy didn't do it once. He did it 5 times. That's it. Goodbye, Charlie. I was out of there. So I guess I'm a germophobic in that regard because I say to people, I don't shake their hand. I do the ghetto thing with the fist. It's a smart thing. It's very Chinese. I like it. People try to shake my hand. Now I do the ghetto thing like a basketball with the fist. They laugh. I said, well, I do it because I don't have to touch your hand. I said, they're smart. The Chinese shook their own hand. They were even smarter yet. You went to shake it. Remember the ancient like pictures? They'd shake their own hand. Well, they need to touch your hand. What's handshakes about? So, anywho, I don't, if I'm in a room, a sneeze, a cough, once is okay, but if it's very fluid, there's a lot of fluid, I leave. I don't like, because I know it's spraying. Even from high school days, they showed, how come in my day, if they showed a sneeze, they showed it in slow motion, and how far a sneeze spread the germs? Like a, it's like 12, 15 feet, right? You knew to avoid. My mother said, don't use a public water fountain. And there were other kids, they'd stick their mouth fountain in Queens. They had like stone fountains and like water. And it was always like never a lot of enough water. It was always like within a quarter of an inch of the spout. There was always like a schmuck would put his mouth over the... He'd like suck on it. You'd think the guy was crazy. I wonder where those kids wound up. They have to have wound up working in government somewhere. I don't mean for Obama. Let's not get absurd. Like the MTA, something like that. So what I'm getting at is I've always been germophobic, and I read a story today that Norway has practically wiped out the superbug that was infecting the nation and has made Norway one of the most infection-free nations in the world. And take a guess what they did to wipe out the superbug in Norway. It's not that they took a drug. It's not that they ate certain foods. It's not that they exercised. It's not that they instituted Obamacare with another incompetent doctor telling you nothing and to go home and take an antibiotic. It's the opposite. Do you know what they did to eliminate the superbug? Do you know what they did to eliminate the contagious staph infection that had been killing tens of thousands of patients in the most sophisticated hospitals of Europe, North America, and Asia this year? Norwegians stopped taking antibiotics. In fact, it became a crime for a doctor to prescribe an antibiotic unless it was a medical necessity. Now, how many doctors in this country will have a patient come in with a sort of nonspecific symptoms of a cough, and they'll give you an antibiotic? And the patient, you know, doesn't know any better, and they take it. And I tell people, is it a viral infection or a bacterial infection you have? Duh, I don't know. I said, well, you may be making it worse with an antibiotic. And they look at me like I don't know what I'm talking about. But now Norwegian doctors know what they're talking about. And they prescribe fewer antibiotics than any other country. So people do not have a chance to develop resistance to these antibiotics. And that comes down to the whole story. A doctor says there If I treated someone with an infection in Spain with this penicillin, I would probably be thrown in jail. And rightly so, because it's useless there. It's a type of penicillin they use on a very specific type of infection. And they say Norwegians now are sanguine about their coughs and colds, toughing it out through low-grade infections. We don't throw antibiotics at every person with a fever. We tell them to hang on, wait and see, and we give them a Tylenol to feel better. Now, I don't use Tylenol. I don't use drugs like that because they're toxic. They're liver damaging, in my opinion. They're absolutely to be avoided, most of these drugs, incidentally, particularly if you have a hangover. Don't you dare use any of those over-the-counter medications. If you have to use anything, use an aspirin. Don't go near those other acetaminophens. You're just going to wind up with a liver transplant eventually. They're toxic to the liver. They're toxic to the kidneys. I've been saying this for 15 years. I've been writing about it for 15 years. I didn't do the original research, but I knew enough to study the original research and to publicize it. And so in Oslo, Norway, they have soothing but non-medicated lozenges, sprays, and tablets. All workers are paid on days they or their children stay home sick, and drug makers aren't allowed to advertise, reducing patient demands for prescription drugs. Now, compare that to America, where every other ad is for a medication primarily for painkillers. Every other medication is a painkiller in America. Every normal quirk and slight this, they want you to drug it to death, and you wonder why there's such a line for a liver transplants in this country. Anyway, the bottom line is that the use of antibiotics became out of control in Norway, and the staph infections became rampant because of the use of the antibiotics. The staphylococcus became penicillin resistant. And now, because they've cut back on antibiotics for generic use, the people are getting better. And the question is, can Norway's program really work elsewhere? I don't want to do a medical show right now, but the solution to kill a superbug found in Norway, the solution is cut back on antibiotics. And your take-home message is, the next time Dr. Quack gives you an antibiotic for a cold or a cough, say to Dr. Quack, is it a viral infection or a bacterial infection? If Dr. Quack gets mad at you and says, I don't know, then don't ever go back to Dr. Quack. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Tests find nothing wrong with Limbaugh's heart. How about with his soul? Do they test for his soul? This is the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. I'm frankly sick of the Limbaugh story, frankly. It's like, you know, the boy who cried wolf. Well, either it was a heart or it wasn't. So what was he in for? What conclusion do you come to here, Rush? Let's stop the crap already. I'm sick of the Rush Limbaugh sympathy hour here every minute. You know, when I thought it was a heart attack, I came in figuring give the guy sympathy. Now the chest pains are nothing, and it was a blessing. You're going to believe this garbage? So what was it then? Well, nothing wrong. So what was it? There's only one conclusion that we've all come to, and I'm sick of it already. I'm sick of this garbage. Because he's a conservative, I got to kiss his butt. I'm not going to do it. No different. Government media complex, it's all one and the same. Jeffrey in Ohio, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Dr. Savage, since it's the end of the year, starting a new year, I just wanted to call and tell you my favorite show that you've ever done. I'm a business owner. I usually tape your shows in the evening. Then I listen to. I go in very early to work. I listen to them the next day. Mm. It was September 25th of 2007. I have probably listened to this show about 40 times.
Wait, hold on. This is like me watching reruns of my favorite TV shows. I can watch certain rerun segments of The Sopranos 10 times. So what did I do that day?
What was so nice is what was going on in the news was Ahmadinejad was coming and speaking before the UN. Ugh. You were absolutely on fire. You said what everybody felt. You didn't want to hear any more about mullahs or Mahdis or the Koran. And one of my favorite lines that you said was, they can put a shoe bomb in his pie hole. And another great one that you said is there were some really stupid callers that day. They were obviously Jew haters who didn't even know anything about history. And you talked about them, don't do anything but gargle with Rogaine, so you grow your hair on the, they'll grow hair on their
yes.
larynx, and you don't have to
yes.
listen to
I used
anything.
To use that line, go gargle with Rogaine.
Absolutely hilarious. What was so neat about the show, though, is everything you talked about. You talked about Kevin Spacey, Danny Glover, kissing the ring of dictators. You were absolutely on fire, and what I like about you is when you get mad, you get mad. You raise your voice. And so many other commentators, they talk blasé. They could be talking about a Holocaust.
Yes, right. Today, 3,000 people died in a bomb attack. And now let's break to an ad. I know. I hear the same thing. You don't know what you're listening to, like drug addicts.
I'll tell you what. One of my favorite things that you do, when you talk about the sheeple, and you have all the sheep with their bells blanging.
Oh, guys, do we have
like
the sheeple sound? Here's the sound of the Democrat voter coming up. Right?
That's yeah. It.
Here's the Democrat voter. Obama's doing the best he can. Give Obama a chance. He's a young fella. You got to give them illegals a road to legal citizenship. They all come here to work. Give the Muslim with a rocket launcher the benefit of the doubt. He's probably just a collector. Don't arrest them when they have jihadist writings. It's against the First Amendment.
I think I know what you're talking about.
You got to put it on as a ringtone. That would be a hilarious ringtone. The sheep. Hey, another one. And during that show on September 25th, 07, you mentioned a book, and I actually went out and I bought the book. I read it, and I was glad that I had read it. It was, I believe, God, Jews, and History.
Oh, by Max DeMont.
What an excellent book. It gave a great explanation, and for a lot of people who don't realize how many Christians died during that period, I found the book very, very enlightening.
Yes, and he was a Jewish scholar, and he himself researched the Holocaust in great detail, and he confirms that between 5 and 6 million Jews were slaughtered mercilessly or worked to death by Hitler and his German friends, and that approximately 1.2 Christians per Jew died. In other words, 7 to 9 million Christians were killed the same way in the camps, and people don't know this. People do not know that. They don't know that the Nazi regime turned on Germans as well, who did not salute Hitler. That's what we're getting at here, Jeffrey.
Absolutely, and I think something you had mentioned then, and it just reminds me, it's even more true today. Those who don't know their history are condemned to repeat it.
Santayana, Jorge Santayana, the Spanish philosopher. Well, Jeffrey, it's a pleasure to have such a fanatically loyal listener. What's the name of the show? September what? The date?
September 25th of 07. Hey, let me tell you one other quick
thing. No, I'm going to send you a free copy of Band in Britain, first of all. I want to thank you for staying on the line, Jeff. Thank you very much. Mary in New York, WOR, we got to move along. Go ahead, Mary, what's on your mind?
Dr. Savage, thank you so much for being on this evening and last night. Didn't expect to hear you on the air addressing the issues. Got a little excited last night. Thank you. Sound a little better this evening.
Stories. You're taking my temperature, my emotional temperature, huh?
No, I detect it, and I'm glad you're calmer this evening. Been a listener since November.
Do you like me calmer or do you like me angrier?
Only to keep you healthy, I want you to be a little calmer because there are issues to be addressed. And since I do live in New York, there's a lot of things going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. The terrorists are the worst, and the incompetence of the Obama administration is frightening. How they've been mishandling national security is a frightful thing to behold. And how he gets away with it with a little help from his friends in the government media complex.
Absolutely. Stay healthy. Enjoy wherever you are.
Yeah, I told you. I've been reading Hemings Motor News, a novel, reading at night, not watching television, dreaming. Dreaming is a part of my relaxation.
Absolutely. I hear it this evening. You're fabulous tonight.
I don't know what I'm afraid to dream tonight, though. I don't know what it's going to be. What if it's terrible?
A little cocktail.
What can you do? What can you do if it's a bad dream? Well, I'm going to go to a Chinese restaurant after the show is over. That's a risk unto itself. You know that.
Yes, I do.
Particularly out of state when you're not like in your home area where I know the two owners of the places I go to. And even there, it depends upon which brother-in-law is in that night. There's one brother-in-law who I get along with. I like him for 20 years. The other one looks like Pol Pot. No, he does. No matter what, he can know you for 20 years. You always feel like he's about to take you in the back and cut. I don't know what it is. He's like angry at everybody. You spend good money in there. One looks like Pol Pot. The other one looks like a benign, nice guy like Henry Kissinger on Prozac. Oh. Thanks for the call. 1-800-449-8255. Where is old Hank tonight? A little birdie tells me that Woody Allen was around last night in some famous place. And someone asked me, what do you think of Woody Allen? And I said, Well, the black people had Stephen Fetchett in the 40s, and they hated him because he played a servile black man, and the whites loved a black Allen as the Jew.
Savage.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you.
It is the Flamingos. I only have love for you on the Savage Nation. Play Misty for me. Don't play it. I want to hear this. I don't want to hear it. I just want to hear this. I'm into like DJ night. It's like dark. I'm in a coastal city in a studio. Audience is smaller. No one's listening. Wallbanger's probably listening. Okay, that's what I think. Like in my mind, Wallbanger's listening. Leprechaun's listening. The Hammer's listening. Stop talking about Rush already with the hospital. What's a blessing? I'm getting mad. He's already had 4 days or a couple of days already of free publicity with the bullcrap fake heart attack. Now already it's a blessing. But what was it? I'm supposed to sit here and say congratulations, send you a Hallmark card? By this story already. It's like a cover story like from the government. I'm sick of it. And that's it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Florida, WC. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Appreciate it. I just showed up tonight. I didn't know if you were live last night or not, but I know you're live tonight, and it makes me feel comfortable. At least you're standing up rather than taking a vacation.
Well, I was live last night. You didn't hear it, though, right?
I tried to go through the different stations, and I didn't get you last night. I'm down here in Sarasota.
Oh, no, I was live and hot as a smoking pistol, as they say.
Well, pretty good substitutes, but let me run something by you here. I'm a writer. I'm retired from the ad agency and television business. Mm. I'm concerned about this FBI and interstate deal with Acorn. Can anything be done? It's federal dollars supporting this organization. It's interstate conspiracy denying people the ability to vote, or let's just say enhancing, however you want to look.
But how much worse does it get than the Black Panthers intimidate voters last November with clubs outside a polling place in Philadelphia? The Justice Department attorney who seeks to pursue them is not only rewarded, but he's busted and thrown out of the Washington office by Obama, or I should say by Holder, that wonderful prize of humanity, and he's thrown down into an office in North Carolina for wanting to pursue the Black Panthers. That's the kind of stuff you would see in a third world. And so you're not going to get justice out of this Justice Department.
You don't know what to picket or demonstrate in front of the FBI office? I'm an activist type of guy, all right? And I'm trying to figure out what can I do at 70 to bring attention to some of these grievances that I have. And what do you do? I mean, it's a scary deal.
You're asking the question of questions when you have a government that doesn't want to hear from you, when you have a representative government that is no longer representative, which happened a long time ago. In other words, how much money do you have to pay to see your representative is the question, right? And, you know, the answer is depends upon how high-ranking he is. Most of them, you have to give him a stack of cash to get them to even listen to you. Do you have a representative in the state of Florida that you could go to with your grievances? The answer is, of course not.
No.
No. So we don't live in a representative government anymore, do we?
Over with you, several years ago, I think during the Bush administration, people were talking about that Saudi Arabia had commissioned 5,000 imams. I remember that word distinctly, 5,000 imams.
And throw them into America here? They're polluting our country by teaching jihad right in our country?
Yeah, but I mean, they didn't say they were sending them all here, but I remember distinctly that Saudi Arabia bragged about sending these emissaries all over the world.
They promote a radical vision of Islam. And if you remember, our dear commander-in-chief was there last spring bowing down and receiving a gold chain around his neck. Remember that?
Yep.
So there's your answer of who you can go to. How much worse does it get than you read that Saudi Arabia and Norway, the governments of Norway and Saudi Arabia, gave up to $25 million each to Bill Clinton last year while his wife was Secretary of State? What does that tell you?
Well, I understand where you're coming from on that one. Let me ask you something, and then I'll get off the air.
William J. Clinton Foundation showed today that Saudi Arabia and Norway each donated somewhere between $10 million and $25 million to the former president's charity. This is while his wife is Secretary of State. We are like a banana republic right now.
Can I ask you one thing?
Yes.
There are no leaders of the senior community anywhere in the country. Like the black community has Jesse Jackson and the other guy with the frizzy hair. I can't remember his name. But there are no leaders of the senior community, and yet AARP has usurped that whole movement and acted basically as their ambassadors. And they have sold out the senior citizens here, and no one even knows what's going on. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, for one, the senior citizens are largely drugged. They're either they're on 5, 6, 7, 8 medications, and they're encouraged to be on these drugs, both by the doctors and by the pharmaceutical industry. And now, of course, with Obamacare, all they want are their drugs. They're like drug addicts. You know, they're like running with their canes screaming, give me my drugs. So they don't need any leadership.
No, I'm with you on that. They got the.
So you're looking for someone to take leadership in the senior community and give them hell, in other words. Somebody to marshal the millions and millions of people who have leisure and commitment to this nation. And you don't know who that is. It certainly is not the AARP. They went over to the Obama side a long time ago. My friend, keep listening, because it's leaders like you or people like you from whom the leadership shall emerge, I believe. But I don't want to get too preachy right now. I want to get back to my original concept of this show, and that was Clint Eastwood, Play Misty for Me, 1957, Monterey, Carmel, California, small radio station, dark of night, playing music. Blah, blah, blah. So let's have a little music to go along with that, and I'm going to get back into the head state, the headspace of just the disc jockey days of talk radio. And I wasn't in radio, by the way. I came to this. Oh, there you go. What is this?
Good night, sweetheart.
No. Kill, break that record, please. That's so horrible. My best point tonight was when I got into my dream and the tenor sax. And you played Desafinado, and then we played Speedo. That was the best point tonight so far. It's been downhill ever since. I hope. I mean, I know when the notes are good, and I know when the. If I were in a nightclub, I know when the first set was the best. The second set was really good. The third set was okay. Now already I'm into like 4, 5, 6. The sixth set tonight in the club already. I'm dragging. Should have eaten before the show. I could feel the sugar. The blood sugar's low. That's the problem. I need Chinese food. It's like the scarf in the container during a show. But I'm not sending out. I don't like takeout. I'll tell you a Chinese food story on vacation. It's a guy who makes sushi. Sushi's very good. So he got to know I'm on the radio. So he has the nerve to say to me after I eat there twice, he says to me, "Oh, Michael Savage, why are you conservative?" I said, "Why?" I said, "You're a communist? You like communism? Didn't you flee from it?" His answer is, "Everyone's a communist. I won't go in that joint again. I don't want to eat a communist sushi. I don't eat raw fish that's communist fish." What, is he kidding me? The guy comes here from another country to make a living. He works very hard. He makes a nice food. How could he not comprehend that he could not do this in his home country? How is it possible that he doesn't understand it? So he said, "Why are you conservative?" First of all, he had audacity to ask me that. Stepped out of line, because he's like, you know, it's like not his business to ask me that. It's a different level. He shouldn't ask me a thing like that. That's number one. But number two, it made no sense. I don't like eating food where communists like are in the restaurant. And number, you know, even if they didn't know who I was, I don't like communist food. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So I need a little music. I need some more music now. Let's go back. There you go. Sea of Love. That's good. Al Pacino brings me back to the saxophone and the mouthpiece needing washing. Why did I dream of washing Al Pacino's mouthpiece from the saxophone? And that's an interesting connection there. Let's not even go there. I feel like Secretary Gates. I don't even want to go there. Woman, the actress who was in, yeah, she was hot in those 70s. Then she like lost it, right? She went all downhill so fast. I mean, I heard of the myth of Sisyphus. Remember when she came on the scene, everyone was like, "Oh man, your heart raced." Then you like looked around. She married like the makeup guy.
sued him for everything, for a fur coat. She looks like the type of chick who would kill you with an ashtray. Doesn't she have that look? Like you wake up one day, like the first day, she's like all sweet and smile. 3 weeks later, she's chasing you around the apartment with a big bronze ashtray. I turned it off. No, I was at the auction, and I bought a number of crates. I bought some nice items, as I said, and like the Indian on horseback and another thing. But I brought, there was an ashtray they had, and I was almost going to buy it. It was like a big glass ashtray, and I jokingly said, this is the kind of ashtray a woman kills her husband with. I didn't want it in the house, to be honest with you. I bought a weird bronze, the weirdest of my life, because it's figurative in the sense, okay, Indian on horseback, you understand, it's like romanticizing the Native American on the horse and the feathers and the what. Looks beautiful, gorgeous. And then there's always like the cherubs. I don't like cherubs, incidentally. It's a second story I was going to tell you tonight, how I always hated cherubs as a child. I hated them. But I bought a small bronze of a gorilla killing a lion with his hands around a lion's neck. I don't know who cast this or who came up with it. And I don't believe that a gorilla and a lion could ever fight because the gorilla's in the highlands and the lion, of course, is in the plains. I don't know that a gorilla and a lion ever meet. I don't know in real nature if it ever happens. And I have a soft spot for mountain gorillas and lions. I mean, I try to protect wild creatures with donations here and there. But this bronze I have is so violent. It's of a monster mountain gorilla with his hands around the throat of a lion on his back who's fighting back. That's a really wild picture. It didn't provoke any nasty dreams in me at all. No, what gets me nasty dreams is Obama playing golf while airplanes are almost falling out of the sky. What gives me nightmares is Big Sis appearing with that aplomb, you know, with the leather jacket, like just shooting the breeze in one of the bars there with a friend. Oh, yeah, we had it under control, you know, like an Irish cop, you know, the side of a mouth. Yeah, everything worked smoothly, and a minute, everyone reacted properly, the passengers, you know, oh, yeah, everything's under control. Like an Irish cop on the beat in Boston already with the leather jacket, tough Janet Napolitano. How is this woman in her job? The next day should have fired her. But I'm not going to go back to that again. I made my point yesterday. Whatever happened to Tiger Woods? Where is he today? Well, she whacked him with the iron, now it comes out. We knew that day one that she beat the back of the car in with the glass. You hear him? No, sorry, wait, let me go back. Okay, the cover story is he had an accident. She was trying to get him out of the back of the SUV with a golf club. So she broke the window to get him out, right? Like, oh, sure. This wasn't an enraged wife chasing a philandering husband with a golf club after beating him up to try to kill him altogether, right? Now, it's the same with Limbaugh already. I'm sick of this already. He goes in with an alleged heart attack. Now I'm fine, and it's God's blessing. I was blessed. Don't give me that fake Christian malarkey that your audience believes in. You know, level with us, man. What happened? We can pretty much figure it out by now. Just stop the malarkey. It's the same thing with Tiger Woods, and I want the truth. I don't want to hear you went in with a fake heart attack and it wasn't. What was it? You got already 4 days. You milked it of publicity. I'm not going to say another word. You got my sympathy out of this, and I'm mad because it wasn't what you pretended it was. You and your handlers, Rush. And you know what? You should be ashamed of yourself for not coming clean. That's my opinion. I'll be back.
Savage.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Out of the mist, your voice is calling. Tis twilight time. When purple colored
it is the Savage Nation. End of day. The government media complex. Beware the government media complex, whether it be liberal or conservative. When they are invited to the White House, it tells you everything you need to know. That's all I can tell you. I can proudly tell you that no one has ever invited me to the White House. Not Bush, certainly not Obama, so you're safe with me. You're always safe with a guy who's never invited to the White House, who's in the media, who's achieved the kind of audience I've achieved. That's all I can tell you. I'm like you. In that regard, I'm an independent and I'm an outsider. And I'm proud of it. And like Groucho Marx said, I mean, I would never join a country club that would have me. Probably wouldn't go to the, I'm down, you know, like I was on vacation. I went somewhere like fancy twice. I enjoy it up to a point. But I can't eat when you get that dressed up. I can't eat. Number one, and then everything is posturing. The food was good. It was very good. People of note and this and that. I don't know how people do it every night of the week. I don't know. There's a different kind of personality to put on the outfit and, oh, there's famous this, there's famous that. You know, there's step and fetch it. There's step and fetch it with matzo balls, you know. I mean, big deal.
What do you have to go there to see him for? You can see one of his bad movies. Washington, D.C., WTNT in Washington, one of my hundreds and hundreds of stations. Thank God. Now, that's a blessing. That's a true blessing, is the stations that I have and the people, the listeners. I lay awake at night sometimes, like, why are they listening? Why do they want to, what do they want to hear from me? What do I have to say that's so unique or interesting that they can't get somewhere else? I mean, it's not that I have doubts. I ask myself, and I answer in a way. The answer is, when I listen to others, I know the answer. That's the answer. Tom in Washington, D.C., welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Michael, Happy New Year from Washington. WCN.
Thank you. Thank you. Should old acquaintance and all that. So what's on your mind?
Well, Michael, first of all, your show last night was truly a masterpiece, and it was just beautiful.
Well, I know what I did last night was very forceful with regard to the threat of Islamofascism. And it's long overdue that more people speak out, or we're going to be in the long run finished.
Right. Michael, you are a doctor of dissent. I'm a retired government employee. I have over 30 years in the federal government. And honestly believe that if these cabinet secretaries took an example from you, we'd be in a much better position right now, Michael.
Now, who? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
Yes, for example, I worked in the Foreign Service for, 22 years in the Foreign Service.
What is a job? You know, Tom, it's interesting you should call. We don't know each other, right? We never met?
That's correct.
When I was a young man, I always knew I could be a good diplomat. I had a certain savoir-faire, and I enjoyed. What is it like to work in the Foreign Service? Is it a good job? I mean, really?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in a specialist side. I was doing technical work, so it wasn't typically the diplomatic work, but I was involved with the overseas.
So who becomes a diplomat? How does a person become a diplomat? Is that basically a purchased position?
Well, it's either an appointee or it's a career position. The ambassadors that you see that are appointed sometimes are appointed, but there is a career path in the State Department.
But is it fun being an ambassador even in for a small country?
I don't understand, Michael.
No, is it fun being an ambassador? A U.S. ambassador somewhere. Is that a fun job?
Yeah, I think so. It's the protocol. But I just wanted to tell you there's an evaluation system.
And wait, but that's like 7 nights a week. You have to put on parties and, right? I mean, it's very formal. Every night you have to meet emissaries and stuff like that. I don't know. I couldn't handle it.
Well,
I'm more of a TV guy and a takeout than all right, so what's on your mind?
Yeah, Michael. Well, the point is they have this evaluation system, you see, and it's based on things like interpersonal skills and communication skills.
Oh, in the Foreign Service, they give you a test, like an IQ test.
Well, that too, but every year you're evaluated, and I was actually on a panel that reviewed these before they went up to the promotion panel just for format.
Right.
And Michael, you wouldn't believe how many times there were statements like, well, you hurt the person's feelings, or you weren't culturally sensitive.
Oh, God. I am so tired of caring about that, aren't you? Why are they
Michael,
not culturally sensitive to America and American mores? How come? What, did we have no culture and we have no sensitivity?
Right.
Well, what do I care about what the Arab street thinks? Do you care what the Arab street thinks? They beat their wives. They beat their children. They're horrible people. What do you mean, the Arab street? They live in the 1600s. Why should we be sensitive to what they think?
Michael, well, it's very complicated, but I just want
to
let
you know. Of course it's very complicated. It's all got to do with donations to the Bill Clinton Memorial Library, $25 million from Saudi Arabia. I wonder what he got that for. What's the $25 million for?
Yeah, that should be investigated, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, while his wife is Secretary of State. So it's like a banana republic, and Dianne Feinstein is a top U.S. senator on the Intelligence Committee, and her husband is a billionaire, and some of his business dealings have to do with U.S. contracts. Nancy Pelosi's husband, fabulously successful businessman before she was in the House, and now that she's been Speaker, one deal after another related to her position. Everybody knows this is going on.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, I have all your books, and it's just wonderful to talk to you. And
well, let's have a great 2010 together, everyone listening to the Savage Nation. And remember, I'm going to make a New Year's commitment. I'm going to pick up a tenor sax this year and I'm going to try it again. I can't guarantee that it'll be Al Pacino's, but I'll get one anyway.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content,
psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You know, I thought for this hour it would be great to play some of the most requested interviews I've done in the last year. James Ellroy, the fabulous fiction writer who wrote many, many important books, came on the show and he was unbelievable, gave a great interview about his new book, Blood's a Rover.
The story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed. To protect the innocent.
Right, and this is Michael Savage, and we're going to shift gears right now from the political machinations of our dear leaders to fiction. We're going to speak with one of America's greatest writers. He wrote L.A. Confidential. Many of you know the movie, if you haven't read the book, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere. Phenomenal books. James Ellroy, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Haven't heard from you in 10 years. How are you, James?
Savage, what's shaking, baby?
I don't know. I know it's shaking, and I'll tell you, there's a whole lot of shaking going on. So you have this incredible book that I have in my hand, Blood's a Rover, a novel. It's summer of 1968. King and Kennedy are dead. The conspiracies have begun to unravel, and a dirty trick squad is getting ready to deploy at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. What is your book about, James Ellroy?
Savage, it goes from the summer of 68 up to the death of gay Edgar Hoover in May of 72. You got the FBI, you got crazy black militants in L.A., two fictional groups, the Black Tribe Alliance and the Mau Mau Liberation Front. You got crazy juju in the Dominican Republic. You've got it all.
It says that the life. It's. I like the piece that goes with it. It says James Ellroy's novel, The Lives Collide in Pursuit of the Red God, Goddess Joan, and each of them will pay a dear and savage price to live history. It says other hallmarks of James Ellroy's works include dense plotting and a relentlessly pessimistic, albeit moral, worldview. You and I share that, a relentlessly pessimistic, albeit moral, worldview, James. I hate to drag you into the political sphere, but I know that you have said things that are worth repeating. You say America has to rule the world or someone worse than us will. Boy, do I agree with that one.
Yeah, it's quite true, and all American presidents come to grips with that. Some of them quite nobly, like Ronald Reagan, others, yeah, let's not mention names, less so.
And then you say, wait, James, and then you say, a capitalist economy has to prevail because massive social programs tend not to work. So apparently you don't have too many friends in West Hollywood.
I don't have many friends in West Hollywood.
You see, James, I can still get a laugh out of you. You know, you were on my show when I was a local host here in San Francisco way back in the beginning. You've gone on to such phenomenal things. Your books are awesome in that they're telegraphic. To me, they remind me of, in a certain way, and don't take it as an offense, Kerouacian in that regard. You cut through the fog with some staccato-like sentences. And I love the texture of the book because it reminds me of the seaminess of L.A., which I happen to like. I'm one of the few people who enjoys there's a seamy side of L.A. that I like. I think you revel in that.
L.A., come on vacation, go home on probation.
Listen to this, electric chair. He couldn't shake the picture. S. kept reminding him. He found that golf course bunker. La Banda left a black guy strapped in. His palms had melted on the electrodes. The restraints burnt them bone deep. That's good writing, James. I can pretty much say I know why you're very successful.
Yeah, you know, it's he was our puppet in the Dominican Republic, Joaquin Balaguer. And there were a couple of, you know, of quasi-leftist, quasi-centrist guys that came in, and then they brought in a guy everybody called the midget, Joaquin Balaguer, and he was our puppet in the Dominican Republic, and Nixon ran him, and nothing happened in the Dominican Republic during the 4 years I needed latitude for fictionalizing, so I had that much more latitude to fictionalize. And Haiti adjoins the Dominican Republic, and you want some crazy, you know what? Boy, oh yeah. Boy, man, oh man, a chef, let's go to Haiti.
Oh, really? It's that bad?
Yeah, oh yeah, Papa Doc Duvalier, the dictator there, he ruled with his secret police, the Tonton Macoute. You had voodoo, you had voodoo sects, you had herbs.
Can I, James, you're very deeply into this whole, as I say, CDLA, and I'm not trying to castigate you in any way. Do you believe in voodoo's powers?
No.
No.
No, voodoo ain't for me. But it makes for damn good fiction.
Your book, Blood's a Rover, fundamentally, this novel, is about, I mean, can you define it, what it's about?
4 years of American history. It's about the war of ideals. It's about that. And, you know, you're a few years older than me. We're about the same age. And you remember that time. Everybody was bombed out of their gourds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there was.
And you say, look, a dirty trick squad is getting ready to deploy the Democratic Convention. Black militants are warring in Southside L.A. The feds are concocting draconian countermeasures. And fate has placed three men at the vortex of history. And the three men are who?
Dwight Holly, strong-arm goon for Gay Edgar Hoover. Don Crutchfield, who is a real-life friend of mine, very famous Hollywood private eye. And Wayne Tedrow Jr., who's a holdover from the previous novel. And ex-Vegas cop with some very, very heavy baggage. Mm. And when I was a kid growing up, I was too bombed to recall the history that was going on all around me. But I sensed that there was always a guy with a briefcase that had a silencered pistol inside of it. And he was a secret implementer of history.
So oh, my God.
Blood the Rover, my new novel, tells history through the perspective of these three guys.
Oh, my God. Do you believe the government still whacks people, James?
I don't think it's done that in quite a while. I think plots to whack Castro boomeranged and got JFK whacked.
This new book is a stunner. It's called Bloods Are Over by James Ellroy. Let me read you a paragraph. It says, Los Angeles, 12/27/1968. One paragraph. The Bureau kept the suite at the downtown Statler. Karen's baby was just born four blocks away. Joan wore a red dress. Dwight wore his most fed gray suit. Christmas lights blinked on Wilshire. The prior tenant left a bottle of Ten High. Joan saw Dwight's ratcheted hands and dosed them with bourbon on a washcloth. It stung. Dwight held tears back. He thought of Thomas F. Narduno and wondered what Joan knew about everything. Joan said, save your hands. You're 52 years old. How do you know that? I'm not telling you. What do you want from all this? Tell me what all this means. That's good writing, James. You should consider a career in literature.
I guess I better write.
Yeah, but what do you mean by Blood's a Rover?
It's a quote from A.E. Hausman, Clay Lies.
Oh, my God, you're kidding me. To an athlete dying young.
Yes, don't even get me going. I'll recite the whole poem. But
wait, James, am I the only person in the American media who knows who A.E. Hausman is?
Yes, you and me.
It was my favorite poem for years and years and years. You know, James, I should have read that right after the Fort Hood massacre. That's what I should have read.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to get distracted with politics, but your book is somewhat political, is it not?
It is. It is. It is a big tale of the dream state of America between 68 and 72.
It's okay. Yeah. Okay. Flat. So that was a fulcrum. That was a fulcrum. It's one of the reasons we're in such trouble now. Do you think we survived the 60s, James? Did we actually survive the 60s?
Yeah, we've survived. We've survived the 60s, and America is going to survive, and America is going to be just fine.
Even with the current group of college teachers running the world?
I think we're here to stay. Call me. It's a vibe I've had. It's a vibe. I've gone into the hole, Savage, let me tell you. I commune with God with a very few people. I don't read. I don't listen to the radio. I don't go to movies. I don't watch television. I'm not on the internet. And I don't have a cell phone.
Mm.
So I'm not the best guy on earth to talk contemporary politics with, but I got a vibe. And here's the vibe.
Right, of course. You have your own tuning fork. And your tuning fork says we shall survive.
Prevail.
Mm.
We will prevail.
All right. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now, here is my interview with Dutch lawmaker Geert Wilders, who was banned in Britain and then taken off the ban list, unlike me. He's not afraid to speak the truth about the dangers Europe is facing in his nation as well from radical Islam. Well, you've been asking for it for a long time now, and now it's happening. Geert Wilders, the Dutch lawmaker who has been castigated for speaking the truth about radical Islam, joins us now for an exclusive interview on the Savage Nation. He was banned from Britain, and that ban was just overturned in the courts. This is his first American interview since he was allowed back in England. Geert, thank you very much for being with us today on the Savage Nation radio program.
It's an honor for me to be on your show.
Well, you're the real honored guest because you've been through, as a movie once said, to hell and back. How many years were you on that list of banned individuals?
Well, actually, I don't know that I was on a list of banned individuals in the United Kingdom, but I heard in February this year when I wanted to travel to the United Kingdom that Jackie Smith, the then Home Secretary, banned me from entering. So I don't think I'm actually on the list, but she just banned me for entering because she thought that my presence would endanger community harmony and therefore public security of that kind of nonsense.
Yes, of course. Well, I'm on a list with murderers and terrorists. It's interesting to me that so-called liberals would link speech with the action of murderers. To them, I guess speech and action are one and the same.
Exactly.
Your movie is the most important part of this discussion. All you want to do is show the short film called Fitna, which explores the Quran. Have you shown that yet in England?
No, not yet. But millions of people have watched it on the internet by now. But no, we plan to show it in March next year, and I still hope I will be allowed then to enter. As you know, the UK courts last week overruled the decision of the British government, the cowardly decision to ban me. So I went over last Friday and talked to one of my friends of the House of Lords, Lord Malcolm Pearson, and we agreed to try again in March 2010. And it was really ridiculous that the UK government thought that there would be some kind of rows or whatever in the streets of London, because I showed Fitna in the United States Senate, in the Parliament of Denmark, in Jerusalem, in Rome, next month in the Parliament of the Czech Republic, and never anything has happened. So I'm afraid, like with you, it's more a political decision than a decision that is based on any law. It's just the dimitude and the weakness of the liberal cultural relativists that unfortunately are in charge in Europe today.
Geert, you know, I noticed while you were speaking, outside were some of the most hate-filled practitioners of the religion of peace, screaming things such as Sharia law will be dominating England, we will dominate, kill those who insult Islam. I thought they were the best advertisement for why your film should be seen everywhere before it's too late.
Exactly. They exactly proved my point. While I was holding a press conference with Lord Malcolm Pearson in the UK Parliament, there were a bunch, a mob really, of Muslims shouting that I should be have capital punishment and that Sharia should be enforced in the whole of Europe, and freedom go to hell is what they shouted. And
you know what I love, Geert? The BBC covered this on Thursday, and they said,
far-right Dutch MP Geert Wilders has won an appeal against the Home Office decision, barring his entry. It's interesting to me that your ancestors in Holland who fought the Nazis, would they have been called far-right as well for standing up to Hitler because they believed in the sovereignty of your home country?
Of course not. And this is exactly the point I also make, the double standard that they have. But don't forget, the leaders in most of the European countries are weak. They are giving in. Most part of the electorate nowadays is also a growing part of the electorate is from Islamic origin. They have a big identity crisis. They don't know who they are. They don't know what culture they should fight for.
Why do you say that the Quran is like Hitler's Mein Kampf? Obviously, that would incite a lot of reaction. Many people would say, wait a minute, are you an enemy of Islam? I know you're not, but I'd like you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I believe that Islam is not another leaf on the tree of religions. Of course, it has partly, maybe 5%, it's a religion. It has religious symbols like temples and a holy book and things like that. But I believe that Islam, unlike other religions, Christianity or Judaism, really has no intention to assimilate or to integrate.
So you are calling for, are you still calling for the ban of 5 years on the founding of mosques and Islamic schools, a permanent ban on preaching in any other language but Dutch, foreign imams should be forbidden to preach, radical mosques should be closed, and radical Muslims expelled. Do you still stand by those principles that you espoused in your book, Honest Talk? In March of 2005, you wrote a blockbuster of a book called Honest Talk. And in that book, this is what you called for. Do you still believe that these points should be implemented?
I really believe that they should be implemented because, once again, the more Islam a society gets, the less freedom we will have.
You're absolutely right, Geert. We'll be back in just a minute with Geert Wilders on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
We're back now with my guest, Dutch parliamentarian Geert Wilders. Well, it's interesting to me that you have to go around with bodyguards since you wrote a book in your country. Are you still under the same protection?
Yeah, for exactly this month, for 5 years now. It started in 2004 because of my publication and what I said in Parliament and about Islam and mosques and radicalism. And yes, I got threats from all over the world, from the Netherlands, but also from Al-Qaeda-linked organizations.
Geert, does your government provide this security detail?
Yes, they do. They do. It's not my choice. If I wanted to have more or less, it's not my decision. It's the Secret Service and the decision of the Dutch Home Secretary to provide when it comes to parliamentarians for protection.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I admire that your government, that at least they're willing to protect you. It's more than I could say for the United States of America, which lets people twist in the winds who they don't agree with. You are not supported, strangely enough, by homosexual groups or women. They're the ones who have the most to lose by radical Islam. Why don't they support you?
Well, some of them do, actually. It's not that they don't support me. They do. Groups of them do support me, because you are right. If Islam would get its way, if there would be more Islamic influence in our societies, all the people that are non-Muslim, whether they are homosexual, whether they are women, whether they are apostates or renegades, or whether they are just intellectuals who are criticizing Islam, they will be the first to pay the price. It's especially the representatives of the Christian belief, however, where much of the Christians support my point of view, that those people, unfortunately, in our multicultural society are appeasing as well, and are criticizing myself, indeed, leaders of the Jewish, leaders of the Christian community. But the real people, the common people in the street, support me. If there would be elections today, my party, and I'm referring to a poll from 2 days ago, would be the biggest party. If there would be elections, I could be the new Dutch prime minister. So there is a lot of support, but there is also a lot of resistance. I have to be honest about that.
Well, your society has always been a very tolerant society, and of course, I'm a student of the immune system, and we also understand how the retrovirus works. If you've studied HIV or any other retrovirus, They usually take advantage of a weakness in the immune system and then mimic the defense cells themselves and then take over the entire body politic, if you want to put this on a political level. That's what's going on in the West, which is that ultra-tolerance has enabled some of these radicals to enter the country under the guise of, let us say, asylum or please help me. They come in, the next day you wake up, they're trying to take over your country and throw you out of your own country, which I don't understand how anybody with any intelligence can't see it going on, which leads me to the next question. Since you wrote your book in 05, have there been changes in your favor, meaning has Holland awakened in any way to the threat, or has Holland become weaker?
Well, let me first say that I agree with the analysis that, at least in Holland and most part of the Western world, we were tolerant also to the intolerant. And what I really hope that we start being intolerant to the people who are intolerant to our societies and to us. And because of this political correctness, we are not. Have things changed? Well, like I said, I represent now at least virtually in the polls, the biggest party of the Netherlands. So things have changed, yes. But when you look at the policy of the Dutch government or the UK government or the German government or the French government, you see very little change. People talk about it more, but when it comes to policy, there is still so much politically correctness, also by the liberal and leftish press in Europe, that it sometimes sickens me a lot. But once again, the people are not fooled. The distance, the difference between the Vox Populi and the political elite is still huge. So we need more changes. We need not only to talk, but to act. And I think that by the next elections in Holland, we could really make a difference there.
Now, you state that a ruling elite exists among parliamentarians who only care about their own personal careers and disregard the will of the people. That's exactly what's going on in America. You have a two-party system that absolutely hates the people. And when the people stood up against the health care reform, which is socialized medicine here, Nancy Pelosi and others called them fascists, Nazis, etc., they were shocked to see the people care about their own future. Your party, who created your party and when was it formed? When did this new party begin?
Yeah, well, I was, before I started my new party, I was a member of parliament for the Conservative Liberal Party, as we say.
Oh, you already were in the system.
I already was in the system, but I got fed up with the current elite and the way they treated me, and I was not allowed and sanctioned to talk about, Islam and Islamization and the defending of our own values. So I left my former party after a lot of disagreement, and in 2004... I started my new political party, the Party for Freedom. It was in September 2004, and we took part 2 years later for the first time in the elections, and we got quite a result for a new political party. And then, because the old political parties only shouted at us and tried to demonize us in any possible way, as they by the way still do, we only became more popular. And the subject about the values and about the Islamization is something. I mean, I hope that a lot of Americans come and see Europe and see that whether you go to Malmö or Copenhagen or Berlin or Amsterdam or Brussels or Paris, that our society is changing, that there is a parallel society where we have Sharia courts, where we have the most terrible thing, honor killings, where we have the most terrible things happening, and that political leaders looking in the other direction. And we really need to save our continent, and my message, I'm in the United States now, is that please, United States of America, my dear friends here, don't think it won't happen to you, because it is happening to you, and you will also pay the price if you look in the other direction and just ignore the facts that are on the ground today.
Your party, could American citizens make contributions, financial contributions to your party if they wanted to?
Well, they could, yes, that would be very helpful for also my defense, because we were talking about the United Kingdom, and I luckily won that one. But in January, my criminal prosecution starts in the Netherlands, also because of my movie Fitna.
Criminal prosecution? A member of parliament for speaking his mind in Holland?
Yes, and this is a very sad thing, because the public prosecutor in Holland decided not to prosecute me. Then some people went to a court of appeal in Amsterdam, and the higher court of appeal ordered my prosecution. I could go for 20 months to jail.
Oh, my God. Well, we've got to help you. Garrett, we're going to make contributions to your legal fund. I know you didn't come on the program today to ask for money, but I know that money is the mother of politics and especially the mother of law in the world today. We know that the opposition, the Sharia folks, are backed with unlimited funds, no doubt from Saudi Arabia and God knows where else. Is there an email address or a fund that's set up? If not, how would they make a contribution?
There was my Dutch website is called www.pvv.nl. P from Peter, the V for Victory, and the V for Victory.nl. And there you also find a link to the English website. And there people can see how they could help. It's not only that I'm being prosecuted for my thoughts in the Netherlands, but also the country of Jordan is threatening to ask for my extradition.
Which country?
Jordan. The Jordan prosecutor.
Oh, Jordan, a wonderful country of freedom, yes.
A wonderful country of freedom,
so long as you're a member of the ruling class. Now, I want to read your website again. I want the millions of people listening to this show to make a contribution, whether it's $5 or $1,000. It's www.pvv.nl. PVV.nl. It's going to go up on my website as well. Many, many people have come to my aid and contributed to my legal fund. And I know that they're looking for good causes that have meaning rather than the Republicans or the Democrats. And I would encourage everyone listening to this show to contribute to a Geert Wilders Defense Fund. And we're going to talk more about that later on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
We've had an amazing opportunity today to speak with Geert Wilders, the Dutch parliamentarian and filmmaker who was banned from Britain simply for speaking the truth about the dangers of radical Islam. Well, he just had that ban overturned in the courts. Geert, welcome back to the Savage Nation. I know you're very busy and you're giving us this exclusive interview today. Has anyone in the American media wanted to cover you here while you're in America? Have they celebrated with you your freedom?
Well, not so far. I intend to speak tomorrow evening at the Temple University here in Philadelphia and Wednesday at the Columbia University, but both are being Muslim student organization are trying to make it cancel this whole event. So there was not so much press now, but in my former visits to the United States, I indeed have been invited by Fox News. There wasn't many shows there. Also with CNN, that was what less pleasant. But I did a lot of press in my previous visits before here in the United States.
Well, I'm honored that you would take time out to warn America. What you're really here for is to warn America that what's happening in your country of Holland is going to happen here, no matter what the fifth column says in this country. And most people don't even know what the fifth column stands for. But today the fifth column is far more sophisticated than it was during the period of the 1930s when Hitler created the German-American Bund, for example, where they ran the American flag on one side of the stage and the Nazi flag on the other, and they had pictures of George Washington and Adolf Hitler on the stage, and they said that Hitler was just the George Washington of Germany and he meant America no harm. We know where that went, and we know what he really intended. In essence, you see a parallel battle today.
I really do. I really see a parallel battle, and my message here indeed is that not only take care about yourself and look forget the political correctness and look what is happening in your own country, but also bear in mind that you are losing an important ally, which is called Europe. We now still adhere to the values of Rome and Athens and Jerusalem, but in 10, 20, maybe 30 years, Europe, if we don't change anything there, and also with the support of the United States, I hope, there will be the values of Tehran and Mecca that will be dominant there. So you are losing not only part of your own identity. I want the Americans to stand up and fight for their own culture, but also you are losing a very important ally in Europe, because Europe is changing, and Europe is changing for the worse, and it is happening here as well. And we really need to stand up and fight for our own values, which are once again not based on Islam, but are based on freedom. And all the freedom-loving people should stand up and say, hey, enough is enough. We won't take any more. And we elect now leaders that are brave. I always say we have enough Chamberlains in Europe. We need more Churchills. And, well, if you allow me to say so, I think the same applies to the United States.
Geert Wilders is speaking today on the Savage Nation, and I want to set the record straight. Geert considers himself to be a libertarian, and he represents the true iconoclastic Dutch society that America and the rest of the world had always admired. But he woke up one day, I'm just speaking for myself now, Geert, forgive me, and he said that our tolerance has created an untenable future for this country. You also say that your allies are not the far-right Le Pen. You said you will never join up with the fascists and Mussolinis of Italy. And you say you do not want to be linked with the wrong rightist fascist groups. And of course, I agree with you 100%, but that's how you are being smeared, isn't that correct?
Yes, everywhere. Everywhere they try to put us in a kind of extremist or fascist corner. And, well, we are not. It's a really an honest decision not to get involved with any party in Europe or anywhere in the world that has anything to do with racism or fascism. I'm a democratic elected parliamentarian, and I only use democratical means within our rule of law. I get a lot of support of it. And let me tell you, Michael, if I really was some kind of extremist, I would be I would be at the margin of the Dutch political system. I would have 1 or 2% of support. Being the fact that we are now the biggest party in the polls in the Netherlands with more than 20% of the vote within a 10-party system, that's a lot, proves that we are not involved with anything that has to do with violence or extremism. We are just standing up. But there is so much at stake that all these leftish and liberal politicians and the press know that they don't want the change that we advocate, and therefore they try to put us in a most nasty corner. But the people are not fooled by that, and they will support the prevention of the Islamization of our societies and fighting for our freedom anyway.
Well, before you go, I want to quote your interview in the UK, because I think that it says a lot. You say, take a walk down the street and see where this is going. You no longer feel like you are living in your own country. There is a battle going on, and we have to defend ourselves. You say, before you know it, there will be more mosques than churches. And so your solutions are pretty clear. If you had total power, which nobody can have in Holland, what would you tell the people need to be done? What should be done in Holland to save your country and Europe?
Well, first, we should stop the mass immigration from people from Islamic countries, not because those people are wrong or bad people, because we have enough Islam, and the mass immigration and the demography is killing our society. So first, the first thing I would do is stop the mass immigration from Muslim countries. The second thing I would do is that I would advocate that people who are crossing the line, who are committing violent crimes and are sentenced for that, should be sent away. If they don't want our society, if they don't want our values, there is no room for them in our society. And thirdly, I would like to install in Europe some kind of, we can learn from the United States, some kind of European First Amendment. Because nowadays, why I am getting sued, and many others, it's not only about me, I'm not even that important, but many people in Europe are being sued because we lack a First Amendment, and people who are in favor of those Islamists, or those Islamists themselves, are suing us incredibly, and they have a lot of money, they have a lot of support from Middle Eastern countries and from anywhere, and we don't. So stop the immigration, be tougher on people who don't adhere to our laws, and thirdly, make some kind of First Amendment, the freedom of speech, stronger in our European constitutions.
Geert Wilders is a member of parliament in Holland. His website is www.pvv.nl. I'm Michael Savage. I suggest that everyone listening to this show pay close attention to what you just heard and make a contribution right now by going on that website. Geert, I want to thank you very much. I know you're very busy today and on a very short schedule. And if we can help you at any time by telephone or any other way, we're going to give you the First Amendment anytime you want it, so long as I'm still on the radio.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was really an honor to be on your show, and I hope you will fight your exclusion order as well, and I'm sure you will win.
Well, God bless both of us. God bless the Western nations while they're still here. I ride my bicycle every day as I go down to a mall to see people. I can't believe what insular people. I'm on a bicycle. I'm riding to a mall. If I didn't almost hit five stupid women walking with cell phones, they see you and they want to make believe that they're immersed in their BlackBerry or their phone and using it as a weapon against you, or they don't actually see you, it doesn't matter. These are the moronic liberal women who elected Obama. They don't know anything. They don't know anything. They're lost in their little, they have a handheld device. And all they know is what comes through the handheld device. And they know Obama's great and anyone who opposes him is a racist white cracker, even though they're white. They're whites. That's all they know. Ignoramuses. Stupid. The empty people, the empty skirts. Now, if you talk to them and you look at them, you look at them from the outside, they're reasonably attractive women, whatever. They dress well. These are the same women who feed their children Oreo cookies for breakfast. Or if they're really sophisticated, they take them to a cafe and they give them a pastry, a croissant, and a coffee or a cocoa. And they want to know why the kid needs Prozac. The mother hasn't the slightest idea as to her own health, nutrition, nothing. She knows nothing about her own health and nutrition. She relies upon experts to guide her with drugs. She's on 6 or 8 prescriptions. And the child is no different. So, you know, I look at things, I'm bewildered by it in a way, on how we've become a nation of drugged victims. Now let's play a little rock and roll.
Riding along in my automobile.
It's Rock and Roll Friday on the Savage Nation.
My baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio. With no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile, I was anxious to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear.
With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.